Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. In these trying times, stories of survival, leadership, and heroism are just the kinds of lessons from history we need to draw on, and I can't think of a better example than the true story of the flight of Apollo 13.
And Apollo 13 is go. T-minus 20 seconds. T-minus 20 seconds and counting. 17, guidance release. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8. Ignition sequence has started. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commit and we have liftoff at 2:13. The Saturn V building up to 7.6 million pounds of thrust, and it has cleared the tower.
50 years ago, on April 11, 1970, Commander Jim Lovell, Lunar Module Pilot Fred Hayes, and Command Module Pilot Jack Swigert lifted off from Kennedy Space Center on what was supposed to be the third lunar landing mission. But about 55 hours into the mission, an oxygen tank exploded, crippling the Command Service Module Odyssey and forcing the crew to use the Lunar Module Aquarius as a lifeboat. In this, the first of two episodes, we'll look back at the epic story of Apollo 13 through the eyes of people who were intimately involved with it. Our guests today include Apollo historian Andrew Chaikin, flight director Jerry Griffin, astronaut Fred Hayes, and flight controller Jerry Bostick. Before going any further, let's get one thing straight. Just like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes never said, "Elementary, my dear Watson," none of the Apollo 13 astronauts ever said, "Houston, we have a problem." Let's listen to the actual mission audio from the time of the accident as Jack Swigert, the command module pilot of Odyssey, and then Jim Lovell react to the oxygen tank explosion.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem. We've had a main beam undervolt.
Roger, main beam undervolt. Okay, stand by, 13. We're looking at it.
That was the actual mission audio from Apollo 13. It amazes me how calm and cool the astronauts are in describing what's going on. But then again, that's why men like them were chosen to fly to the moon. Let's start our look back at Apollo 13 by putting it in historical perspective with our good friend Andrew Chaikin. He's the author of the book A Man on the Moon that Tom Hanks used for research in creating the HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon after he played Jim Lovell in the movie Apollo 13. I asked Andy Chaikin to tell us about the historical context and significance of Apollo 13.
You know, it was a big moment because we were just coming off of two incredible successes with the first two lunar landings, Apollo 11, which of course had shown the world that human beings could actually leave the planet of their origin and travel to another world and actually land and walk around on it. And then Apollo 12 had sort of upped the ante with the first pinpoint landing on the moon. And that was significant because the real interest was in going back to the moon for science, to say, hey, this is not just an engineering achievement, but this is a world that is waiting to be explored. So Apollo 13 then was the first time NASA was sending astronauts to the moon purely for scientific exploration. That's why Jim Lovell, the commander of the mission, chose a motto for the Apollo 13 mission patch, Ex Luna Scientia, from the moon knowledge. So that was the aura of anticipation surrounding the launch of Apollo 13. And they had picked out a very interesting place to go on the moon, a place called the Fra Mauro Highlands. This was quite a bit different from the places where Apollo 11 and 12 had gone. Both of those missions had gone to relatively smooth areas on the moon. Of course, Apollo 11, the prime consideration was safety. You know, you're doing something that's already pretty darn risky, so let's pick an area on the moon that presents the least risk just in terms of the topography. So they picked a very relatively smooth place that was an ancient lava plain. And they picked a similar spot for Apollo 12. Well, Apollo 13, they picked this region called the Fra Mauro Highlands. which was a rougher place, more rugged, more of a hilly terrain. And it was actually thought to be material that had been blasted out of a gigantic impact crater. Actually, craters that are hundreds of miles across are called basins. And this was a basin called the Imbrium Basin. That's the Latin word for rain. And we know this feature as a dark splotch on the moon. If you look at the full moon and you think of the man in the moon, then the dark lava plain that fills the Imbrium Basin, which is called Mare Imbrium, the Sea of Rains, that would be the man in the moon's right eye. So by going to the Fra Mauro Formation, geologists would finally be able to analyze the samples the astronauts brought back. They would be able to finally get some information on when this gigantic basin was formed and when this material was blasted out of the deep crust of the moon.
Where was the American public during this as far as their attitude towards Project Apollo? Because famously, in the movie Apollo 13, they show that the television broadcast isn't picked up by the networks. Had the American people and the media really lost interest in the moon landings after two times being successful at that point in 1970?
I wouldn't go so far as to say they'd completely lost interest, but it was certainly decreased from what it had been during Apollo 11 or even Apollo 12. I was absolutely floored when I came across an article from the New York Times dated December of, it was actually during the mission of Apollo 12, November of 69, and they were quoting, you know, they did sort of man on the street interviews and people were saying, yeah, it's just not as exciting as the first time. I thought, you're kidding me, right? You know, this is the second time human beings have gone to another world and walked around and you're already getting bored. But this seems to be part of, I don't know, this is part of the way the American public treats the incredible. It rapidly becomes the commonplace. And that was already setting in by the time of Apollo 12 and by the time of Apollo 13, you know, think about where the country was, right? I mean, the Kent State shootings of Vietnam War protesters happened just a month later. That is a great kind of data point, kind of pin in the map of where we were as a country. And in fact, I remember a science writer, a friend of mine from my Boston days, told me a story about when he had been at Duke University as a student during the Apollo 13 mission. And he said to one of the professors, do you think they'll get them back? And the professor thought he was talking about the soldiers in Vietnam, not the astronauts.
Yeah.
This was a divided country by the time Apollo 13 was ready to fly.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. If you're just joining us, this is the first of our two-part look back at the Apollo 13 mission 50 years ago. Joining us next is one of the many heroes of the mission, one of the flight directors at Mission Control in Houston. Not only was Jerry Griffin smack dab in the middle of the Apollo 13 mission as one of the four flight directors, he also served as a technical advisor for the Ron Howard movie starring Tom Hanks. Griffin joins us from Houston, Texas. I asked Jerry Griffin where he was when he first learned of the oxygen tank explosion that crippled the command module Odyssey.
I had just gotten off duty, and my goal team had, and I had gone out to play a softball game and left it with Kranz and his team. And I, by the way, I've never let him forget that I left him with a perfectly good spacecraft, and he managed to screw it up. So I walked back into the control center, and I still had on my sweats and my baseball hat, and I could tell by the look right away that whatever had, I didn't know what had happened. There were a few more people in the room. It was calm, but a lot of stern looks, and so it took me maybe 5 or 10 minutes to get caught up on where they were. Glenn Lunny's team had already arrived because they had come in early to relieve Kranz. And so the room was kind of full. And so all we did was I hung around for a while. And I said, holy moly, I got to get back in here eventually. So I better go home and get some sleep. And I did tried and didn't work too well. None of us.
I was going to say that must have been about impossible to sleep knowing what was going on.
In fact, I finally got it. I got up 3 or 4 hours before I was due back and took a shower and went on back because I knew I wasn't going to sleep anymore. But anyway, it was serious. You could tell it was a serious error, but you know, nobody ever panicked or anything like that. We had been trained to kind of, you know, keep working the options, and that's what we did. But it took us a while to figure out what had happened. And we knew we had lost the oxygen, but we didn't know why. And we knew there'd been a bang, and we didn't really know that the tank had blown up until we actually saw the picture that Lovell took after they separated the service module.
Right, the famous that one whole side of the spacecraft is missing when he saw that.
Yeah, we just knew it was had to be some kind of dramatic event that got both tanks, and which killed the fuel cells and which meant we couldn't produce any water, which meant we couldn't produce any electricity in the CSM. And thank goodness we had the batteries in the lunar module. And you know, Dave, there's a very important point about that accident. If it had not happened about where it did, we could have really been in deep trouble.
Why is that?
If we had been, say, halfway to the moon, then we would have had an even longer traverse to go around the moon, let gravity help us get home. And we were a little, you know, we never did burn the service propulsion engine after the incident because we didn't know what had happened back in the service module that might have gotten it too. And so that's why we used the descent engine on the lunar module to make maneuvers. If we had gone to the point where they had separated and gone down and landed, well, in fact, if they'd even gone down and aborted and could have gotten back to lunar orbit, even with the descent stage, it would be pretty much used up. And so the batteries and all that would have been much degraded. And if they had landed and all they could get back to the service module and command module in lunar orbit was the ascent stage, it was curtains. Wouldn't have made it.
Gosh, so, you know, in that sense, you know, thinking about that, and I've thought about this before, but you really drive the point home. We were really lucky with Apollo 13 in that sense.
Amen. If it had to happen, about where it happened is as good as it could have happened. And I think even if we had just left lunar orbit with the command and service module only, headed home, and it happened then, I'm not sure we could have made it. I kind of doubt it because there's just no way to produce enough power. We would have chewed up the command module had two little reentry batteries in it that powered the spacecraft after you separated right before you entered the Earth's atmosphere coming home. And that had enough power. It would get you back in and on the deck. So it happened about as optimum as you could pick that kind of event to happen. And so it was dicey. But, you know, as it went on, and this is an important thing, I think one of the things that I think the success of Apollo was built on was the fact that we trained so hard. We simulation after simulation. And they could throw problems at us, and we would take them in stride and keep going until they could drive us to our knees. Eventually, the sim guys could put enough errors in, we couldn't handle them all. And they did occasionally. But what that did for us is that it never give up. It was really the, as long as you have options, just keep going. And so we did. We never ran out of options. We got close. We got very close. But on water, particularly, water turned out to be our biggest shortage, and that's, it just wasn't, we weren't producing any with fuel cells, so we almost ran out of water. And I think that's the, that tells, people have asked me, even the young flight controllers that are now talking about going back to the moon, when we talked to them, all of us, they said, you've got to get yourself prepared. Don't cut short on training and preparedness. And, you know, we never once, Dave, mentioned not getting them back. It never came up. A lot of people, I think, have a hard time believing that, but it's true. We never talked about it. And it just wasn't in our lexicon to talk like that, and so we didn't. And, man, was it nice to see those parachutes.
Oh, I bet. Can you comment on, you said that you were at the softball game and then they came and got you, Ed Findel told you that, you know, you got to get back, and that happened a lot. Couldn't you give us a sense of how all hands on deck this was, and that the Mission Control Center there in Houston, and not just Moker, but, you know, the whole building, it was, there were a lot of people there working this problem, weren't there?
Amen. And they were, the rooms were, had more people in them. Again, I'd emphasize, it was not a bunch of people running around. It was pretty calm. But, you know, one of the reasons I couldn't sleep is I didn't want to miss anything. You felt like that if you left, you weren't going to turn it off anyway. And now I've lost track of what they're doing and what's going on. So the rooms had more people in them. If you look at that room when during the entry was jam-packed full. It was as full as it was on the Apollo 11 landing, where there was hardly a place on the floor that people were sitting. They didn't want to miss it. They wanted to see it and be there and hear it. And so, it was all hands, but we had to get some rest. We had, you know, most of us had little kids. Not little, maybe not quite so little as they were early on in the program, but you know, we had school-age kids, and all of that kind of mixed right in with everything else, and then we had the Apollo 13 tank blow, and it just kind of threw our whole world in a bit of an uproar for about 3.5-4 days.
You're listening to Blue Dot. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our look back at Apollo 13. And we'll be joined by one of the two living crew members, Fred Hayes. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's go now from the perspective of Mission Control in Houston to inside the two spacecraft Odyssey and Aquarius that made up Apollo 13. We're joined by one of the many real heroes of Apollo 13's story, Lunar Module pilot Fred Hayes. After serving as a backup for Apollo 11, Apollo 13 was Fred's first, and it turned out, only spaceflight. Hayes was supposed to command Apollo 19, but the moon flights were canceled due to budget cuts after 17. Fred Hayes, a.k.a. Freddo, joins us from his home in Mississippi. Fred, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
I'm glad to be aboard. Me and I got Tito here ready to with all ears.
Okay. You know, I'd like to start out by having you, since you're going to be the only astronaut we can talk to about this out of the crew, with, of course, Jack Swigert no longer being with us. I would like you to give us a little thumbnail sketch of your crewmates. Could you first tell us about Jack?
Okay. Well, Jack was a fellow member of the original 19. That was what John Young, I think, nicknamed our group when we joined the program in 1966. And so I had a lot of time with Jack through the first year of training, where as rookies went through, actually partway through that year, we didn't even get a full year. They put us to work before we got through the year. But at any rate, so I was with Jack on a lot of training exercise, field exercise with geology, classroom, survival training. Jack, describing him, he was a bachelor, a little heavy, stocky side, I'd say. I think he played guard for the University of Colorado. And he's very gregarious, outgoing, happy-go-lucky sort of fellow. He hosted winemaking parties at his apartment when in Houston. I never was very good at that. Joe Kerwin was a good winemaker. But anyway, he did those kind of things. It turned out it was the same thing on our post-flight trips. Jack was very good because he was the one that was outgoing. If they had some local fair, like in Greece, where Greek dancers wanted someone from the crew to join, Jack was always the volunteer to go try to do that those dances, which I would be too embarrassed to try to do. So that was Jack, pretty much. He obviously, like most of us of that era, were in the same mold of being military pilots in our background, test pilots. So, you know, competent in that sense as well. Jim, I'll describe as having a commander and knowing the personalities of many. I'd say he was perfect for the Apollo 13 role, which took a lot of patience to deal with the situation, which obviously was disappointing. And one accord, because this was Jim's second time to the moon, and obviously wanted to land, and lost that chance as I did. I'd really worked with Jim through two previous crews. I was the backup with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on Apollo 8, and Jim was the prime crew. He was the prime command module pilot on Apollo 8. In fact, that's what I did. I actually replaced him in the backup crew. He was on the backup crew, and when Mike Collins got ill, had a medical problem,
dead and neck
injury, moved up to the prime crew, and then I served. Obviously, Jim was my commander when we were the backup on Apollo 11, and then to be with Jim on Apollo 13. But he was very confident. He was a very even-minded kind of person. Like I said, he had a lot of patience to deal with the waits we had to wait for the next steps in Apollo 13 and procedures that they were working on the ground. Only in one time did I think he got a little upset and pushed them to get our power-up procedure for the mothership Odyssey to get it earlier so Jack and I would have a time to study it a little bit. And that was about the only time he kind of lost his patience. It was a little more abrupt, I'd say, in his call and request to mission control.
You know, those were your crewmates, and I'll ask you about the movie stuff later. But what I'd really like to get into that not too many people discuss is you guys had some very serious scientific objectives, and you were one of the first crews that really did some serious geology training with Lee Silver from Caltech and working with the USGS as well. You really seemed to take to it. Did you enjoy the field trips and the geology?
Yeah, very much. You know, you're in nice, picturesque outdoor scenery, and The setting was nice. It was good to get away from simulators a little bit and have that experience. Geology I found interesting in the sense of thinking about time domain. You know, if you think sort of roughly, you think of an astronomy, which I'd been exposed to as well in training. You think about distance, about how far apart things are. And geology, you think of, of time. Like the first geology trip they took as rookies on was to the Grand Canyon. And from the top to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, which is kind of a layer cake, you go over a billion years when you get down to the units down at the bottom of the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, it's like the concept of deep space and deep time.
Right.
Well, let's get back to the mission. And of course, you know, the oxygen tank explosion, which happened on April 13th. At what point did you and the rest of the crew, when did it dawn on you all that this is really serious?
Well, it's serious in one sense for me was when I did drift up through the tunnel and got to look at the instrument panel. And there was quite a few caution warning lights on, which was confusing because it crossed systems that had no relation to each other, various spacecraft systems. But the one thing that stuck out was the 2 meters for the cryo system, the oxygen and hydrogen. The needles in 2 of those meters for oxygen tank 2 were in the bottom, which told me that we had lost that tank. So it was not life-threatening. I thought we still had tank 1, and it was good. But it was just a sick feeling in my stomach of disappointment, because I knew if you lose one major system component like that, it means an abort. So I knew instantly there within the first scan of the panel, we had lost the landing. That was my feeling at the time. As I said, I didn't think it was life-threatening because we had the second tank.
Yeah, the crushing disappointment, knowing that you're not going to get to achieve your goal of landing on the moon. And then at what point does it become clear that it's more serious than even that?
Well, after about 50 minutes, I think it was over 50 minutes, because it did show up with a slow leak in the second tank. And we went through a number of steps trying with mission control, trying to stop the leak. And so really it was about over 50 minutes before it was apparent to all that we had run out of ideas. And they asked Jim and I to go start powering up the lunar module.
Yeah, and normally how long, if you were just doing that under normal circumstances, how long would that take?
I have no idea of the lunar orbit timeline, frankly. It would vary because at different steps, you normally stop and mission control would check something, that kind of thing. We did not do the normal power-up, obviously. We skipped whole pages in the checklist. But things we knew we didn't need. We didn't need a landing radar. We didn't need a UHF-VHF communications because that's for rendezvous. So we had a number of things in the checklist we just bypassed in that power-up.
And then, of course, once you have to go into this amazing lifeboat procedure using the lunar module, I think one of the things that's dawned on me, looking back at this mission and the research that I've done and some conversations that I've had with Jerry Griffin, for example, is that in a sense, it was very unlucky what happened to you. But in another sense, in a very real sense, you were extremely lucky that this happened when it did and not later.
Yeah, certainly. Obviously, if we'd used up the limb, for the most part, landing, we wouldn't have had a lifeboat. So, yeah, clearly it was at a time we had a good, completely loaded, viable lunar module to serve in that capacity.
On the way back, you had to conserve power, and that meant the spacecraft got very cold. And you got pretty ill, didn't you?
Well, I picked up what is a UTC, urinary tract infection, probably about a day and a half out before entry.
And how sick were you? It must have felt terrible to be sick in that cold spacecraft with all that going on. There's a famous scene in the movie where Jim Lovell gives you a hug because you're really cold. Did that happen?
No. That was a little dramatization, but that was fine. UTC, or urinary tract infection, you apparently never had one.
Yes, I have. I have.
You know, you get chills and fever and you're burning when you urinate.
Yeah. No, it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah. So it's kind of like having a little bit of the flu in one respect, like yeah. The chills and fever.
Well, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the movie and your take on it. For example, your take on Bill Paxton playing you.
I thought Bill did a good job. He kind of over-exaggerated in a few scenes, and that, again, was just to add some lightness and drama to the movie about my playing jokes, so that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. He worried about that. I met him and took him on a tour of Kennedy before they started filming. And he had never played a live person in a movie. So he only played fictional characters or people who were long gone, like in a shootout at the OK Corral or whatever.
Yeah.
And so he worried about how I would view things. And I told him not to worry. It was not the life story of Gandhi. It was simply 6 days in my life. So, you know, I thought he did fine.
And could you give us, what would be something you tell us that they really got right in the film and maybe something that you found maybe slightly disappointing?
Well, I mean, the basic flow and chronology of how things went was true. They over-exaggerated vehicle motion in most respects for things they showed that were dynamic, like the manual maneuvers we did, burns we did. We didn't even move 1 degree in two of those manual burns we did, corrections we did without the computer. They were very short. One was like a little over 14 seconds, and one was like 21 seconds.
And I do have to ask, there's the moments of tension between you and Jack on the spacecraft. Did it happen that way or not?
No. If I had been in the right couch position where I normally would be, and they had asked to stir the cryos, I would have been the one to stir the cryos.
Yeah.
So there was no way you could look at anything on the panel and say that electric short was going to happen. No, that was, again, dramatization. I queried Ron Howard a little bit about that. Special showing we had about a couple of things, but one was those sorts of things added in. It was interesting. His comment was that, well, you know, that NASA gave me all the air to ground for the whole mission, all the radio transmissions, and I listened to all of that, and it never sounded to me like you ever had a problem.
So they created one.
So they had to create some stuff to add drama. But at any rate, that was also the reason. The other thing I had was, you know, you didn't use any of our lines. I said, you know, the only line you used was, Houston, we've had a problem here. And he said the same thing. I listened to all of that hit the ground, and I knew if I used any of it, no one would understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, because you actually the quote from the movie is, Houston, we have a problem, but that's never actually said. It's, you know, finally says, Houston, we've had a problem. Well, it is a movie, not a documentary.
None of our real lines were ever in the movie except that one.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, let's talk about the people on the ground that worked so hard to get you home safely, the flight controllers. Could you just tell me, especially, you know, 50 years later, how you feel about those people?
Well, I mean, we were family. You know, I'd worked, like I said, I'd been two previous missions, Apollo 8 and 11, where I trained as much as the prime crew. And you saw that in our flight, obviously, where Jack filled in 2.5 days before launch. Mm-hmm. You were equally ready to go fly the mission as a backup. And so I had all the same kind of number of training hours and simulators working with Mission Control and meetings with Mission Control as the prime crew. We all were attending those together. So I knew the people well. I could, you know, but recognize voices when I later listened to some of the tapes with mm-hmm. the troubleshooting going on. So some of them were actually family, lived in the same neighborhood that we lived in.
And I'd also like to ask you about when we did our program about the restoration of Mission Control Moker 2, that the iconic Mission Control Room, you know, that's, you get to see a version of that in the film. And of course, we've seen it in many documentaries, and it's been restored. There's a mirror over the drinking fountain there that the crew of Apollo 13 presented to flight control. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it was in the vehicle. It was used to look at the hookups and suit hookups and things like that. That had that advantage to give you the look, not for makeup, but more for mechanical things. And it was one of the things, a number of things that we removed from the limb before we left it. And we thought it was a great thing to do to have it mounted as it had been, as you mentioned, on a plaque with a saying under it that I can't repeat offhand exactly, that showed our appreciation for the work they had done. Now, it was kind of extreme on Apollo 13, but most people don't realize every mission had problems. And so ours was not unique. Apollo 14 and 16 almost didn't land because of problems they had. That had to be worked out. Oh, they would have been aborted missions.
Yeah, and Apollo 12 was hit by lightning.
Yeah, Apollo 12 hit by lightning. You're right, right off the launch pad.
Yeah.
So it was not unique, the business. And the training we did was that way. We did very few simulations, only near approaching launch in the last couple of weeks, that they did not put in tests with failures. To be dealt with during our what we call integrated simulations. So it was a good group of people that were well versed in handling problems. Many of them planned, of course, to handle. Ours was only unique in that there were some things that had to get invented that had not been ever thought of.
Before we let you go, looking back at the events of April of 1970, 50 years later, it must have been disappointing to not get to land on the moon. But, you know, as you look back on it all of these years later, what's the big takeaway you have from your experience on Apollo 13?
Well, it's not just Apollo 13. I would just say looking at the what's happened since in programs and with NASA, I just feel very fortunate to have been around as a military pilot and a test pilot with NASA, actually. For me, it was just a transfer when I went into the astronaut program to have the chance to be around and be accepted and get into the program, which was obviously, as we've seen, a very unique program. Some people call it the golden age of space. And so I feel fortunate to have been able to take the part I did with training for four different missions, even though I only got to fly one of them. But it was exciting times.
Yeah, well, you got to ride a Saturn V, and not too many people can make that claim.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to share with us, you know, some of your memories about the training and you know, setting the record straight on some of the things too, that people might, you know, get from just watching the movie. I thank you for that, and thank you for your service to our country.
All right, thank you.
You're listening to Blue Dot. When we come back, we'll continue our look back at Apollo 13 with some of the people directly involved in the mission. After a short break, we'll return and talk to one of the key flight controllers, Jerry Bostick. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And we're back. I'm Dave Shlohm, and thank you for listening to our special program about Apollo 13 50 years ago. Let's turn now back to Mission Control in Houston and talk to one of the many heroic flight controllers who literally saved the astronauts' lives. Jerry Bostick was a flight dynamics officer, also known as FIDO, there in Mission Control in Houston in April of 1970. Jerry Bostick, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you, Ed. I'm very pleased to be here.
And, you know, before we go any further, for those of us who love the movie Apollo 13 or watching documentaries, when you see the flight director go around the horn and talk to all of you guys at your consoles, they always ask you by your acronym, and yours was FIDO. Can you tell us what FIDO stands for?
FIDO stands for Flight Dynamics Officer, and he is the person that's responsible for trajectory and guidance of the spacecraft.
Yeah, and that's vitally important. You have to know exactly where that spacecraft is and where it's going. Can you tell us, where were you when the accident happened? You were on console when that happened, weren't you?
Correct, I was. I was there when the explosion occurred.
And so to kind of set the stage, we had just ended a television broadcast, and it wasn't long after that that who would it have been who asked for them to stir the cryo tanks, the oxygen tanks? Who would have asked for that?
That would have been the ECOM, the Electrical and Environmental Communications Officer.
And would that have been John Aaron?
No, it was Cy Liebergott.
Okay. Cy Liebergott at that time.
John, unfortunately, was not on duty at the time, but he came in very shortly afterwards. So.
Yeah. And then at what point, can you explain to us, at what point for you and the flight controllers in Mission Control, at what point do you realize that this is a real, as they say, problem?
Well, the first that we heard, that I heard, and the rest of us in the control center heard, was from Jack Swigert. And he said, Houston, we've had a problem. And we had, even though we knew Jack, had only done simulations with him for about a week prior to then. So it was hard for me, and I think the rest of the flight controllers, to tell from the tone of his voice, you know, how serious a problem it was. But then immediately after he said that, Jim Lovell came on and said, Houston, we've had a problem. And we could tell instantly that by the tone of his voice, because we'd worked with him so much, that, yes, we have a serious problem here.
Yeah, and for the record, it's not Houston, we have a problem. It's, you know, Houston, we've had a problem.
Correct, right.
Yeah, and at what point for you, you know, just personally and, you know, everybody around you, at what point did it, you know, it start to really set in that this was threatening the end of the mission, you know, if not their very lives?
Well, the first thing that we did in the flight dynamics world was to see if it was possible to do a direct return to Earth. We had just passed the point of no return, as we called it, and had advised the astronauts that a direct return to Earth was no longer possible. But we knew that there was some fuzz on that number, so we ran it immediately again to see if it would be possible to do a direct return to Earth. And yes, it was, if you burned the main engine on the service module, the SPS, or service propulsion system engine, to fuel depletion, you could possibly have done a direct return. But it didn't seem prudent for two reasons. We suspected that the problem that Jim Lovell was telling us about had occurred in the service module, and it probably affected the service propulsion system engine. And also, it wouldn't, even if it didn't, it wouldn't be a good idea. It wouldn't be prudent to burn it to fuel depletion. So it was, that's when we started looking at other alternatives.
You know, in the movie Apollo 13, the flight directors are all kind of boiled down into one character. Of Gene Kranz's character is played by Ed Harris. But, you know, in reality, there were four flight directors. And I'd like you to tell our listeners about one of them in particular, because he comes on at a pretty critical time. Could you tell us about Glenn Lunny and what he did and his role in coming in just a little after all this?
Yes. Well, yes, Glenn was the flight director, and he had just entered the control centers to get ready to begin his shift after Gene Kranz had finished. And he used to be a flight dynamics officer, so he understood exactly what was going on. And in fact, when he entered the mission operations control room, he came directly to me and said, "What's going on?" And I told him everything I knew, and I said, "It looks like, you know, there's no way that we can return to Earth directly. We just need to get onto a free return trajectory." And he immediately said, "Yes, that's what we got to do." And so I was very comfortable to have the oncoming flight director, Glenn Lunny, be an ex-flight dynamics officer, and he understood, you know, what we needed to do, and it didn't take a lot of time to explain to it.
Can we talk about the movie for a moment?
Sure, yes.
So I really like the story of the tagline, failure is not an option, that you see on the movie posters and, you know, made so famous in the movie. Tell us the origin story of failure is not an option.
Okay. Script writers for the movie, Bill Broyles and Al Reinert, asked me if I would meet with them and talk about what flight controllers do and what flight controllers really did on Apollo 13. And so we met at a local barbecue joint and had a nice discussion about flight controllers. And Bill Broyles asked a question. Well, was there ever a time when somebody in the room just panicked? You know, will the flight control? And I said, no, we never panicked when bad situations occurred, like it did on Apollo 13. We just calmly laid out all the options, and failure was not one of them. And I sensed immediately that Bill Broyles was kind of distracted. He began to looking around at the ceiling and pictures on the wall and stuff. And I thought, okay, well, he's heard enough from a NASA nerd. And he's, in fact, immediately he turned to Al and he said, okay, Al, I think that's probably enough. You know, we've got enough here and we'll let Jerry go. So then I found out later they walked into the parking lot and Bill screamed out, that's it. That's the tagline for the whole movie. Failure is not an option.
Oh, that's such a great story. So you really are, you know, the origin of that famous line.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't get a copyright for it.
Well, Jerry Bostick, it's been a joy to talk to you, and thank you so much for your service to our country. Because, you know, without you and your colleagues, the story of Apollo 13 might have ended much differently.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. It was a demanding situation that we had, but it had a very successful outcome, and I'm very, very happy about that.
Before we let Jerry Bostick go, I asked him about the risks of spaceflight in light of tragedies like the Apollo 1 fire in 1967 and the losses of the two space shuttles, Challenger in 1986 and Columbia in 2003.
Well, obviously, you know, to think about disasters, if you want to call them that we had. It was not just starting with the Apollo 1 crew. You know, it was not just a loss of astronauts. It was a loss of friends. We knew them very well. Our wives knew each other. Our kids knew each other. We families socialized. A lot of us went to the same church together. You know, it was a tragic loss. And then the same thing could be said of the Challenger. You know, I had left NASA just a couple of weeks before the Challenger accident. But I knew every one of those people very, very well, close friends with them and their spouses. And it was just a deeply personal thing, as well as being obviously a big technical problem. I did not know the people on Columbia as nearly as well, but it was also a great tragedy. You know, space flight, human space flight is a risky business. You know, anytime you get on a huge launch vehicle and with millions of pounds of fuel and say light the fuse, you know, that's a big risk. And unfortunately, you know, we had some situations where that the risk turned out to be a tragedy. But even though we took a risk, I can easily say also that we never were reckless. We never did anything reckless. We knew the risk, and we assessed it, and were willing to accept the risk, but we didn't do anything reckless.
Thanks to all of our guests, space historian and writer Andrew Chaikin, NASA flight director Jerry Griffin, Apollo 13 astronaut Fred Hayes, and flight controller Jerry Bostick. Be sure and tune in next time for part two of our look back at Apollo 13, when our guests will be Barbara Lovell, astronaut Jim Lovell's daughter, who was 16 at the time of the flight, and flight controller John Aaron. He helped figure out how to preserve as much of Apollo 13's sparse and dwindling power supply as possible in a legendary feat of problem solving. While we are all dealing with the terrible ramifications of the coronavirus, it's both instructive and inspiring to look back at the lessons of leadership, survival, and problem solving from the historic mission of Apollo 13. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this and past episodes at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed nationally by PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is produced and engineered by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.